Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Henderson Hill, Senior Counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union Capital Punishment Project, who is currently representing North Carolina prisoners who are challenging their death sentences under the state's Racial Justice Act. Mr. Hill has spent decades as a public defender, capital defense attorney, and civil rights advocate, including serving as director of North Carolina's Death Penalty Resource Center. Prior to his work at the ACLU, he was the founding director of the Eighth Amendment Project, a leader in the national movement to end the death penalty. Today, we'll be discussing the recent North Carolina Supreme Court rulings in two Racial Justice Act cases that have the potential to change the entire landscape of North Carolina's death penalty, and how the same types of racial bias that have been found in the Racial Justice Act cases are present in death penalty cases across the country. Henderson Hill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be with you. I can't imagine a more important conversation than this one.
Well, thanks again for joining us. North Carolina's Racial Justice Act has had a complicated, to say the least, and convoluted history since its passage in 2009. Four prisoners overturned their death sentences, and the state Supreme Court reversed those rulings. While that was happening, the legislature retroactively changed the rules for filing Racial Justice Act claims, and then it repealed the law altogether. Then the courts reimposed death sentences on the prisoners who had won their claims and dismissed the claims filed by everybody else. Now, I want to go into the whole history of the act, but let's start with 2 weeks ago. The North Carolina Supreme Court issues opinions in two of the cases, Andrew Ramser and Rayford Burke. What were those decisions all about?
Well, Rob, they addressed what we in North Carolina felt was a shameful history of both the prior rulings of the state courts in North Carolina, both at the trial level and Supreme Court. But what was especially shameful was the conduct of the North Carolina General Assembly. You know, that back and forth that you described, it was hard to live through. First of all, the court, the North Carolina Supreme Court, had gone some 30 years without enforcing Batson. And we've got sister states in the South who have had a dozen reversals based on race discrimination and jury selection. But time after time, capital litigators in North Carolina raised Batson with clear protectional reasons, and those motions were denied, and no case was ever reversed by the state Supreme Court. Well, in 2009, the legislature, newly excited majorities, Democratic majorities, with the sort of Obama wind in their sails. Well, actually, they were debating over two issues, two capital-related issues. One was the exemption of the intellectually disabled, and the other was the Racial Justice Act. And what got pushed through that legislature was the historic legislative achievement of the Racial Justice Act. It was, in fact, the answer to the McCleskey decision, which had invited state legislatures to be the laboratories in the criminal justice system to make efforts to root out elements of race discrimination. Well, North Carolina took them up, took McCleskey up, passed the Racial Justice Act, made it possible for statistical evidence of race discrimination to be introduced into court, and together with other evidence, made it possible for prisoners to convince a judge that race played an undue part in the return of the death sentence. So we all celebrated that act as a historic accomplishment, only to see, as the winds of political change in 2010 with the elections then and with the subsequent legislatures, that Racial Justice Act was repealed.
You mentioned the prior cases that had gone through the North Carolina courts and how over and over again the courts had basically ignored clear evidence of discrimination. The numbers are staggering. Between 1986 and 2014, the appellate courts in Carolina ruled on more than 100 cases, 75 of them in the state Supreme Court, in which defendants said the prosecutor had struck black jurors because of their race. And every single time, a prosecutor said it wasn't because of race. Here's some other race-neutral reason. The state courts agreed with the prosecutor. How is it even possible that no defendant ever won any of those cases?
two scholars wrote a North Carolina law review article 3 or 4 years ago asking that very same question. How is it possible? Well, it was only possible because exclusion of African-American jurors was a deliberate tactical choice by prosecutors. They were trained in the dark arts of using pretexts to exclude citizens from jury service. They were not limited to the imagination of North Carolina prosecutors. They went out to Texas, and to Georgia, and picked up some of the skills and the tricks that other prosecutors use. And in their prosecutor training sessions, their continuing legal education sessions, they came up with the top 10 lists of the best tried and true pretenses for excluding African-American prospective jurors. And time after time, those pretexts were successful at the trial. The embarrassing truth is there had to be complicity at the judicial level, both at the trial court level and on appeal. And that's what the Racial Justice Act was so incredibly helpful in undoing, that complicity, and bringing into the criminal justice system the same tools of the scientific method that we use in public health, that we use in transportation, housing, every other field of human activity, to identify the problem and to point the direction towards the solution. They should be used in criminal justice. And so statistics were permitted, were authorized as part of what a prisoner could use to prove discrimination.
So the act passes in 2009, and a lot of prisoners go into their county trial courts to challenge their death sentences. What happened to those cases? Who gets a hearing, and how does that affect the other cases?
I think upwards of 150 prisoners filed these petitions in various counties. There is a group of lawyers coordinated by the Center for Death Penalty Litigation that attempted to reach out to the Attorney General and to the District Attorney Conference and see if we couldn't get some complex litigation designation. Could we bring some order into litigation under this? What everyone agreed was a historic, powerful piece of legal weaponry. And it seemed to make sense to bring the Attorney General in to bring some rational litigation efforts by the bar to elucidate this statewide problem. Well, the prosecutors refused to cooperate. They didn't want organized litigation. And one of the things that was so sad and disappointing was, well, we had litigation going on in the Superior Court, and instead of the prosecutors, and in this case it was the local district attorneys as opposed to the Attorney General, instead of litigating transparently in the Superior Court, they were playing a legislative game. So instead of being transparent with the Superior Court, they were putting in place stall tactics, motions to continue, sort of frustrate the conduct of hearings under the Act, and running to the legislature, seeking amendment and repeal at the same time, never telling the courts about the legislative strategy. So what happened was we had one court in Cumberland County that put the motions on a litigation schedule, kept the district attorney's feet to the fire, asked for reasons, asked for justifications for continuances, granted continuances, yes, but in each case sought for reasons and justifications. And when those justifications failed, he moved the case towards litigation. And we ended up having four cases go to full evidentiary hearings. We had a powerful statistical study under the basic model that Dave Baldus introduced some 20 years ago, with the perfections of 20 years of research study to that methodology. And we put on powerful statistical evidence showing that that African Americans were discriminated at a rate sometimes 1, 2, 3, up to 11 times as frequently as similarly situated white citizens. It was powerful testimony and essentially uncontested.
That particular hearing was under the name of Marcus Robinson, one of the capital defendants in North Carolina. What I found striking, the study was by a couple of Michigan State University professors, Catherine Grosso and Barbara O'Brien. And they looked at 20 years of jury selection and found the patterns were virtually the same in every county across the state over that 20-year period. When you asked for the study, did you expect to see numbers like that?
I think every trial lawyer felt, yes, we expected something similar. It was mind-boggling when you looked at Iredell County, the two cases that were decided, Burke and Rantoul, both all-white jurors in both cases. And we had seen in case after case that the number of all-white jurors was just incredibly high. But beyond that, the number of jurors where there was a single African-American juror. And anecdotally, trial lawyers thought that having one African-American on the jury was almost as bad as having none. And it just seemed so inconsistent with the population of the counties that you could have a capital trial with one or zero African-American jurors. So I think, yes, lawyers were prepared for that kind of those kinds of numbers. Because as trial lawyers, we're sitting through the process and hearing what seemed to our ears to be clear pretexts. This African-American juror is unqualified because she's got a son about the same age as the defendant. Well, you've got a host of white citizens with sons and daughters the same age as the defendant, and that never causes them a problem. This African-American juror here has a prior arrest for drunk driving or public intoxication. Well, these acceptable white jurors over here have long histories of public intoxication and all manner of criminal histories, both in their personal lives and those of families. And how is it that those factors could be determined for African-American jurors, but of no moment for white jurors? So, yeah, we lived with those inconsistencies. We lived with those pretexts. We felt confident that a scientific, sound scientific analysis would prove up the discrimination. And lo and behold, it did.
So Marcus Robinson wins his hearing, and he wins it based on the pervasive, and that's the judge's language, the pervasive discrimination over the course of two decades all over the state. And the legislature then amends the law to make it harder for a defendant to win Racial Justice Act cases. You've given us a hint as to why they did it. What exactly did they do?
I'm trying to get the timing right. You know, Marcus Robinson's case went to hearing, and then shortly thereafter, within the year, three other cases from Cumberland County also went to hearing.
Right.
And so some of the same kind of evidence was put on. The state had yet another chance to meet that evidence and didn't. And so their allies in the General Assembly said, well, you know, short of repealing it, we can amend and take the guts out of the Racial Justice Act. So what they attempted to do and what they did in their repeal bill was to strip away the ability to bring evidence of statewide discrimination, strip away evidence of judicial division discrimination, and narrow it down to only statistical evidence of discrimination in the prosecutorial district where the crime occurred and where the trial occurred. You know, that took some of the most powerful anecdotes, some of the most powerful statistical inconsistencies out of the quiver that a defendant could use. It sort of made it less automatic. It took away the automatic feature of a defendant's right to a hearing on his motion for appropriate relief. There had to be a showing of some substantial cause to believe that race impacted the outcome. So there was mostly the geographic narrowing of the proof that was possible to be admitted that the change occurred. It also, in a sort of weird way, required a waiver of the defendant's interest in a sentence other than life without parole. I'm not quite sure the significance of that, but they thought and that was important. So they put these mix of amendments in basically to frustrate what they had seen as four successful litigation experiences under the RJA. And that did have a chilling effect across the state. I mean, the Superior Court judges were looking at that and thinking they couldn't continue. And it sort of brought uncertainty in for a brief while before they got enough the numbers and before they won over the governor's house and they could seek the total repeal.
Now, some people have suggested that the total repeal was a brazen power play that was designed to be discriminatory. They've looked at the overall history of this North Carolina legislature when it comes to the rights of African Americans and when it comes to both access to the courts and access to the ballot box. Do you see a relationship between the really controversial disenfranchisement of Black voters through the legislative redistricting and the repeal of the Racial Justice Act?
Absolutely. And that relationship became a key part of the litigation before the North Carolina Supreme Court. And we studiously combed through the legislative history of the repeal bill of the RJA amendment effort. And shameful does not overstate the conduct of the General Assembly. When you looked at the legislative history, when you listened to some of the floor debate and the discussion, it was so clear that the legislature was seeking to undo the four decisions in Cumberland County. I mean, if ever there was proof of ex post facto legislating, it was right there in black and white in the legislative history of the repeal effort. You know, the Fourth Circuit in a subsequent case, NAACP versus McCrory, looked at this General Assembly and looked at its attempts at withholding the franchise from African-American citizens and said that the General Assembly acted with near surgical precision to undercut access to the ballot by African-American citizens. It was that same legislature that acted with similar surgical precision to take away the franchise from African-American citizens when it comes to their jury service. It was just remarkable, and it was actually painful to see that deliberate, intentional conduct by our legislators. And to their credit, legislators, both white and black, gave voice to what was going on. And so the legislative history of the repeal is loaded with these kinds of pointed, accurate, and objective criticisms of what was going on right before. You know, sticking the legislature was essentially sticking their head in the sand because at no point was there any objective criticism of the study of the Michigan State researchers. So this is one thing that the court sort of focused on in oral argument, that what we've got before us is overwhelming evidence of sustained discrimination that hasn't been challenged. What are we to do about that? And the legislature had no answer. And we were all gratified that the North Carolina Supreme Court provided an answer. And it provided an answer that has a rich history in North Carolina jurisprudence. And that is to say, a vindictive General Assembly can't go and undo the law and thereby victimize people who have been whose rights have already been secured.
And I think one of the ultimate ironies is that the case on which the North Carolina Supreme Court relied in saying that the retroactive repeal violated the North Carolina state constitution was a case that protected a Confederate soldier.
Well, Rob, I hope you're sitting down because you really can't make this stuff up. Colonel Keith was a Confederate soldier who was riding in the mountains between Tennessee and western North Carolina, rounding up southern white folks who had refused to be conscripted into the Confederacy. And so he had rounded up 13 white men, and men is used advisedly. There are three or four kids who are 13, 14, I think 15 and 17, and marched them from the mountains in North Carolina over to Tennessee, where they were going to be held for trial. They never reached Tennessee. He had these 13, I believe it was 13 men lined up in groups of five and then executed, summarily executed on the march to Tennessee. They never got to trial. They never got to Tennessee. As part of the Civil War effort, there had been an Amnesty Act passed to sort of relieve soldiers from prosecution after the war for conduct that was done during the war in the course of their service. And Colonel Keith would have and did benefit from that Amnesty Act. Then in 1868, the General Assembly and political leadership had changed. And now you had unionists in control. And they moved to repeal the act so that something as heinous and as criminal and as cruel as this massacre, those responsible could be brought to justice. And so an effort was made to prosecute Colonel Keith for those crimes for which he had received amnesty. And the North Carolina Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Ex post facto prohibits you. One vindictive General Assembly can't go back in time and undo this pardon or amnesty. The rights of Colonel Keith and similarly situated soldiers had already settled in. Well, that same legal theory, that same theory had been actually cited by the United States Supreme Court. And it had been cited, not frequently, but by other courts interpreting ex post facto jurisprudence. And so this was precedent in North Carolina for well over 100 years when the RJA came across. And lo and behold, the same legal principle was applicable here. You know, one vindictive General Assembly can't go back and undo essentially a grant of amnesty, relieving a certain class of people from a certain class of punishment and undo that legislative grant ex post facto. The remarkable irony of relying on this Civil War precedent to begin the process of undoing hundreds of years of racial discrimination and racial terrorism visited upon the African-American citizens of North Carolina could not have been more powerful. And to have seen that play out in the North Carolina Supreme Court was just a marvelous experience. And actually to see the discomfort of the advocates for the Attorney General's office trying to justify, trying to reconcile these two positions, that it was something special. And I think part of the power of Justice Earle's decision just a couple of weeks ago was putting the Racial Justice Act into that historical context that has real special meaning for the state of North Carolina.
Now, both Mr. Ramseur and Mr. Burke, so they win. Even under the amended law, they won. They were required to present evidence of discrimination in their own cases in addition to any kind of statistical evidence. I found the evidence that they presented was really disturbing, startling. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners what they presented and how common things like that are in the North Carolina trials.
Well, it really did seem like a grab bag of some of the worst aspects of racialized litigation. Not uncommon in North Carolina. First of all, they were both black men tried by all white jurors in a county rich in the history of racial terrorism that goes back decades, if not since the war, since the Civil War. But you know, part of it is the argument to this all white jury uses the language that we see in a lot of these cases where Mr. Burke was described as a big black ball. You know, just an explicit effort to dehumanize. You know, you didn't get that all-white jury by accident. three of the four eligible African-American jurors were peremptorily excused by the prosecutor. And what we had talked about before, the pretexts that were used to disqualify jurors were just so obvious. You know, one juror says that, you know, the crime scene pictures would be gory and that it would make her nervous. Well, that was disqualifying for the African-American jurors. But those white jurors who said that they would be uncomfortable and that the photos would unduly affect their review of the evidence wasn't even a speed bump for the white jurors. So in Mr. Ransour's case, in some ways, the racialized aspects was even stronger. Again, it was an all-white juror. And these jurors were exposed to racialized fear of Mr. Ransour and of anyone black. You know, during the first part of jury selection, half the courtroom, the half behind the defense table was cordoned off with crime scene tape, protecting the first three or four rows from being filled by Mr. Ransour's family. The only black people in the courtroom were relegated to the last two rows in the courthouse, clearly imprinting the same sort of back of the bus mentality that African Americans had no role in this exercise of community power, this franchise given to jurors, or to just fair treatment in the courthouse. Ransour in particular was caught up in a spirit of demonization that preceded the trial in terms of pretrial publicity. The two victims were white. And clearly sympathetic. These were innocent victims, a customer and a staff person at a gas station. But some of the language that dominated the public conversation, the op-eds and the call-in shows and the community talk, they literally used the language of lynching. You know, that this N-word doesn't deserve a trial. We need to just sort of string them up. You know, the quotes were explicit references to the state and to the nation's history of racial terrorism, specifically saying he ought to be strung up on a tree to send a message to them. And the them is not left for your imagination. They're vermin. You know, those kinds of racialized terms were rampant through the lead up of the Ransour trial. And that same kind of toxin filled the papers and the airways after the trial. So if ever there were two cases that sort of modeled the need for the courts to step in and to ensure equal treatment under the law, Ransour and Burke, you know, sort of modeled that need. And what the Supreme Court found incredible was that a trial court could look at these papers and say that they weren't even entitled to a hearing, that there were no merits to their claims of discrimination. You know, the ratio of African-Americans disqualified by peremptory challenges or excluded by peremptory challenges as compared to white citizens was greater than 11 to 1. And we were shocked when those ratios would be 2 or 3 times to 1. In Iredell County, 11 to 1. So yeah, the court, those two cases that were decided by the court and through which the court decided the merits of all prisoners who filed under the RJA clearly illustrated the root cause, the reason why this was such urgent legislation, such important legislation.
So what happens now? Obviously, Mr. Ransour and Mr. Burke get hearings. What happens to the other folks, and what happens to the four prisoners who had already had hearings and won?
Well, we're hopeful that the answer to your last question is clearly suggested by the court's decisions in Ransour and Burke. The four clients, two of whom were my clients, Marcus Robinson and Christina Walters, They already had their hearing. They're already persuaded, met the burdens of the RJA, persuaded the Superior Court, received life without parole sentences, had already been transferred. Miss Walters had been transferred to general population off the roll for more than 2.5 years. Had started educational programs, had started family engagement programs with her two young children, and had all of that ripped apart by the repeal. So I certainly hope, and most people looking at the court's decision expect that the decisions of the Cumberland Four will come down in short order. And when it does, these four will not have to go back for resentencing. And in fact, their life without parole sentences can be and should be, and we hope will be, reinstated. Yeah, as to the 140-odd other folks who, like Mr. Rensselaer or Mr. Burke, did not have hearings, we anticipate that the great majority of them will have hearings. The court, in reviewing the repeal, the amended RJA, did a very nuanced evaluation of whether ex post facto law prohibits the entirety of the amended RJA, and determined that it didn't prohibit the entirety of it, that one provision of the amended appeal was procedural in nature and could withstand ex post facto litigation, and that is whether or not a petition is automatically entitled to an evidentiary hearing based upon the filing. And the court said, no, that's procedural. And the amended MAR, the amended RJA says the Superior Court just has to make a finding that there's some substantial merit to the filing. We believe, based on the statewide study, based on the judicial division study, all of which will be relevant and admissible for each of the 140-odd cases, that we should be able to prevail. In addition to that, each case has evidence of racial discrimination that is individualized to the prosecutorial district, that's individualized to the actual case that was prosecuted. So we look with tremendous confidence that all of the 140-odd petitioners will have evidentiary hearings, and that once granted an evidentiary hearing, the evidence of discrimination will be overwhelming. In fact, the court found in the Superior Court judges' rulings in Burke and Rensselaer to be abuse of discretion. We're in the face of basically uncontested statistical evidence, powerful anecdotal evidence, and clear pretextual conduct by prosecutors that have been identified by Supreme Court jurisprudence consistently as pretextual. Now, all of that added up to substantial evidence of that race played an undue role in the selection of jurors. So the final word is not written. We look with confidence that the Cumberland Four will have their life sentences reinstated, and that the 140 other petitioners will have evidentiary hearings to have their claims resolved.
Now, North Carolina has not had an execution in nearly 14 years. And the courts will, if we end up with 140 plus evidentiary hearings, likely spend years considering the Racial Justice Act claims. What do you think this will mean for the future of the state's death penalty? Do you think the death penalty can withstand case after case of all this evidence of discrimination?
Oh, Rob, I answer that question this way. If you go back to 2010, shortly after the Racial Justice Act was passed, that was 3 or 4 years after the last North Carolinian was executed. I recall having conversations with district attorneys then about how futile the death penalty was in North Carolina, that they were spending so much time and energy on a sentence that they simply had no confidence would ever be carried out. This was in 2010 and 2011. We're looking now 8, 9 years later, And I think they have got, prosecutors have got to be honestly questioning the value of this policy, even if they are personally committed to the death penalty as from a policy point of view, from a pragmatic good government advocate for your community point of view, it's a senseless waste of resources. When I started work in North Carolina, the prosecutors were all old white men who were 20 years older than I was at the time, men in their 60s and 70s. You know, prosecutors now are in their 30s and 40s. The death penalty simply doesn't play the same role in these individuals' professional lives and their views of justice and the appropriate operation of the criminal justice system. These younger prosecutors have a different, more nuanced, more informed view of racial equity and criminal justice. So I think there's a very good chance that individual members of the DA conference and the DA conference itself will reassess the merits of the death penalty and whether it's worthy of the tremendous resource suck that that the penalty has been for decades in North Carolina. And it's time to turn the page. It's a powerful statement when the RJA received almost a unanimous decision, 6-1. And, you know, more evidence that elections have consequences, but also evidence, you know, very consistent with the national discussion going on now about racial equity in the criminal justice system, that times have to change. And we need to be looking for transformation in how the criminal justice system operates, and most especially how it operates within the African-American community and in communities of color. And I think this death penalty conversation, which I believe the RJA will renew, is a very, I think, high-profile way in which the state can demonstrate that it's moving beyond some of the racist legacies of old North Carolina. So I'm welcoming this conversation. I think that this is the right time. This is a period of an inflection point for the death penalty and for racial equity in North Carolina.
Now, before I let you go, we've been talking about the Racial Justice Act litigation in the context of North Carolina. The same problems are endemic in virtually every state that has a death penalty. So I'd like to sort of turn to the national context. You were involved in Curtis Flowers' case, a likely innocent man who's been tried 6 times by a prosecutor who unconstitutionally struck black jurors in case after case after case. I represented Harold Wilson in Philadelphia, who was exonerated on retrial after we showed that his prosecutor had a pattern of striking black jurors in more than 20 cases. And just recently in Georgia, Johnny Lee Gates walked free after 43 years. His lawyers discovered jury selection notes from his prosecutors that showed that they had systematically excluded black jurors from 7 capital trials to impanel all white or nearly all white juries to try black defendants. You've litigated across the South. How pervasive are the types of racial bias that have been found in the Racial Justice Act cases in other death penalty cases across the country?
It's an inherent part of the death penalty, the legacy of race discrimination, of racial terrorism. You know, Brian Stevenson and EJI did a study of 6 Southern states that demonstrated that the same tenacity of discrimination, regardless of which Southern state you look at, the same pretexts, the same tactics to exclude African-American jurors from service. Yeah, you know, one of the most powerful studies that impacted North Carolina was a study in Philadelphia that showed the enormous bias of the death penalty. And it seemed as if the only people on Philadelphia's death row, or the folks on death row from Philadelphia, were African-American men, young ones, and dark-skinned ones. You know, we worked in Delaware during a legislative campaign But during that very same campaign, we dealt with the frustration of black citizens being excluded from jury service in capital cases. Delaware is one of the smallest states in the country, three counties in the entire state. But each one of those counties found the same pretexts for excluding their black citizens from service on capital juries. You go as far west as Washington. You know, they recently abolished the death penalty by judicial decision, but part of the momentum behind the finding of arbitrariness was the consistent use of race in jury selection to discriminate against black citizens. And the state of Washington has made an enormous contribution to the national discussion with promulgating General Rule 37, which really invigorates the challenge to pretextual use of peremptory challenges. So yeah, I think whether you're talking about the Deep South, whether you're talking about the more genteel South, whether you're talking about Philadelphia and Delaware or Washington, the connection between the old racial legacy of the death penalty and the current of lynching and the current operation of the death penalty system is overwhelming and powerful, and it needs to be rooted out. Any visit to the two facilities that EJI recently opened up in Montgomery makes it plain that the tie between the current modern death penalty and the old legacies of racial terrorism is impossible to deny.
Anderson Hill, thank you for joining us on Discussions with DPIC.
I appreciate the invitation, and thanks for fostering the conversation.
To learn more about the death penalty, visit the Death Penalty Information Center website at www.deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to learn more about the ACLU Capital Punishment Project, visit aclu.org. To make sure you never miss an episode of Discussions with DPIC, subscribe with your podcast app of choice.